I'm gonna draw you naked in the next book I do. That's that.
You haven't
Oh.
already? Let's not make that a perk for our Patreon members,
Oh
please.
my God, this is weird. Please edit
Next month.
that out.
CCF in depth.
How you doing, Jeff? I'm George.
How you doing, George? I'm Jeff. This week's episode, we are talking about Marvel Comics under Roy Thomas. From 1972 to 1974, Roy did a lot of important things before that and after that. But for that brief three-year stint as editor at Marvel, he made substantial changes and had a huge impact on both Marvel Comics and the industry as a whole. We've invited Rob Allen to be our guest today. Rob is someone who has long followed and assisted in Roy Thomas's Alter Ego magazine. He's a guy who was reading comic books when JFK was still president. He's a man who knows his stuff. So Rob, welcome to the show today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
It is great to have you here today. So gentlemen, Roy Thomas's editorship, what do you associate with that? What is big about this era? Why are we talking about it today?
Well, expansion, more comics, more genres, more sizes and shapes of comics. They were trying a lot of new things. And it started a little before Roy became editor-in-chief, but new series, new genres, new characters, and new artists and writers. Lots of good things continued and got better, and lots of new things started.
Now, Rob, you had first gotten into comics around this time period. How much of this did you understand as a reader at the time?
Well, I was enjoying it.
Good answer.
I loved all of this stuff. You know, I of course, been in the 60s. I read Spider-Man and Fantastic Four and Avengers and Tales of Suspense and Astonish. But when I came back into comics after my brief hiatus in 1971, and suddenly there's Conan the Barbarian and Kirby is gone, and now they're launching the month before Roy became editor, and Kazar has taken over Astonishing Tales, the Defenders has launched Ghost Rider, the first Ghost Rider story, Warlock, and Bill Everett's Return to Submariner, which was so fantastically well done. I just blew me away what Bill Everett was doing in Submariner when he came back with issue number 50.
So you understood the significance of that even back then as a kid?
Yes, I did. Well, a kid. At this point in May 1972, I was 15 and a half. So I'm not sure how connected I was to comics fandom. But I certainly read everything there was in the bullpen bulletins and the letters pages. And even if I hadn't, just looking at the artwork, I was really getting into different artists and their styles. And Everett was really, really unique.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
George, were you reading at the time that this was happening, 72 through 74 Marvel?
Yeah, I started reading comic books, I would say about 1970, 71. That's when I really started seeing how great Marvel was and how prolific Roy Thomas was on the writing end of it. You know, I got to tell you, the subject of this podcast is Roy Thomas's editor-in-chief era. And I just don't see that he did a lot of revolutionary things when he was there. It seems like most of his legend was as a writer, because he was the first one to come in after Stan Lee and sort of take the baton and keep going. I remember him from writing Avengers 35, you know, like after Stan Lee had almost been doing all the comic books on Marvel, he needed someone to take over too. And Roy Thomas seemed to be the closest to his vision to what he was doing. But I'm sorry, we might have to tangle a little bit on this. But I don't see how he revolutionized anything. Most of everything that he was doing was already in place. His real contribution was as a writer, and as a writer creating things. But as far as him expanding and creating things new for the Marvel comic books, I don't even know what you guys are talking about.
I kind of love that you hit that right out of the gate. I wasn't expecting this objection from you, and it's actually, I think it's going to make this episode way more interesting. Is this your tinfoil hat theory, or are you going somewhere else with that?
No, I love Roy Thomas as a writer. He's one of the top three writers of all time in comic books. But as far as editor-in-chief, he did 3 years. Three.
Yeah.
Well, that's nothing. That's nothing. And I felt everything that was under his charge, it was already happening. And the things that did happen under his charge, he was writing it. So you talk about Warlock. You talk about Warlock, and you talk about those other. I'm sorry, guys.
I think Rob is slowly dying in the background. It's hilarious.
Let me finish, and then you can attack me. But what I'm saying is that
we'll get into the nitty gritty later on, George. But that's okay. Give your opening claim now, and we'll respond to it later as we get to it.
My claim is that his thing was as a writer, which he was great. He took. He's like the second Stan Lee. Stan Lee was writing all the books, pretty much. And he was keeping the continuity and everything together. And he needed someone that was just like that. And Roy Thomas was just like that. Okay, so that's his contribution. If you look at everything during the years that he was editor-in-chief, his writing is so prolific. He's like writing everything.
Right.
So that's really where his contribution was. I don't know that he had any ideas beyond the writing part of his career.
I think Rob and I are super triggered right now, but we're gonna hold that for a moment, because I think I would at least say this to begin with. I think Stan Lee would agree with your perception of Roy Thomas. I think that's how Stan saw him. I think that's what Stan wanted from him. But before we go super deep on that, let's stay general for the moment, because also we have people reading, listening right now, who maybe don't know much about Roy Thomas's time as editor, maybe know the name, but don't really know much about what he did or didn't do. So let's start basic for a moment and give sort of a little history on who Roy Thomas was and how he stepped into this position, if that's all right. So Roy Thomas, at 4 years old, already has something remarkable happen to him that hadn't happened to anybody else who was working at Marvel at that time, which is at the age of 4 years old, he discovers a love for comic books. And that's incredibly important because he is the first person to step into the Marvel offices who's entering having been a fan first. Stan Lee famously said in a moment of frustration once, let me find the quote. He said, "I can't understand people who read comics. I wouldn't read them if I had the time and wasn't in the business." These were guys who had been in publishing, who had made comics as cool as they could. It's not they didn't care. Stan Lee cared very much. Jack Kirby cared very much. A lot of these other guys cared tremendously, but they'd never been on the receiving end of their work. They had started as professionals first. Roy Thomas came in having spent his entire childhood loving comic books. His mom read them to him. It was a source of love for him. And he also, you know, he said in many interviews that for him, it was also, it was an opportunity because he wasn't a kid who had a lot of money to buy the more expensive things kids had to play with. He couldn't buy electric trains. He couldn't get into the more expensive hobbies. But comic books, anyone with 12 cents or 10 cents when he started, could be entertained. And so this had been incredibly important to him growing up. You know, and also when he was a little older, he got involved in the creation of Alter Ego magazine. You know, he was helping to run a fanzine, which was originally run by Jerry Bales. But and this would sort of set a precedent for later in Roy Thomas's life. He was sort of the go-to number two. And when Jerry Bales couldn't do it anymore and his successor couldn't do it anymore, they said, "Hey, Roy, you do this." And he said, "Sure." And that's kind of becomes who Roy is in many ways. But he keeps Alter Ego going. And at the same time, also, this is why another reason I must love Roy Thomas so much. I didn't know until I was researching this that he was a high school English teacher at first. So warm place in my heart for Roy Thomas right there. But George, why don't you take the reins from here a little bit? How did Roy come to Marvel?
Oh, brother. I tell you, it turns out he came to New York to work for DC Comic Books. He did some correspondence with Julius Schwartz, who he was a big fan of. But somehow, when he got here, he got connected to Mort Weisinger.
Here it goes.
Who, as we all know, is the son of Satan. He's the real one. He's the real son of Satan.
And, every time you talk about him, it gets even more intense. Keep going. I love this.
No one's objected so far.
how do you top that next time? Son of Satan. Wow.
Just hold my beer. But anyway, yeah. So what happened is he started working for him, and he was trying to learn, but he said after a week he wanted to quit. A week. He said he wanted to quit because this guy was just so abusive. And just browbeating the whole time. And, you know, he was looking through his options. He said he couldn't just go back. I mean, I guess he could go back to teaching, but he said he didn't really like teaching as much either. But he wanted to do what he wanted to do. So he got into contact with Stan Lee, who he idolized. Stan Lee, he said, you know, he actually said Stan Lee was writing the best comic books at the time. So he wanted to meet with them. And when they had the meeting, Stan Lee kind of like gave him a writing test, and he wrote a dialogue for something that was already like the pages. And afterwards, you know, I guess sometime after that, Stan Lee offered him, he said, what could I do to get you to come and work for Marvel? And said, and Roy Thomas said, well, just make me an offer. Because I hate it over there. He didn't even try to haggle or make, you know, he just said, I hate it over there, and just offer me what they're offering me and I'll come. And Stan Lee said, well, can you start right away? He says, well, I have to go first, you know, go there and tell them I'm leaving, and I may have to stay there a couple of weeks, you know, because I don't want to leave them in a lurch. He said when he went back to Mark Weising and told him that he'd got another job with Marvel, but he would stay on for a few weeks, Weising just said, get out, you're a spy. Get out. So he went to work for Marvel, and I think at the beginning he was doing proofreading and little editing or corrections and stuff, until later on he started fully taking over as writer for certain, for I think Sergeant Fury and Sergeant Fury, Millie the Model, and X-Men, things like that. So, I mean, you have to thank Mark Weisinger, and if he had been a different human being, it might have changed the course of history.
You heard it from George first. Thank the son of Satan, he says.
He's the son of Satan. Sorry. No one has ever disputed that, ever.
It's funny. Roy Thomas is, the more interviews I've read and listened to with him, he is just such a polite, kind human being who doesn't seem to have many mean things to say about anybody, even people who wronged him. And even he calls Weisinger a son of a bitch, which is kind of amazing. And the funny thing, too, just to add on to that as well, is, you know, because he is a pretty humble guy, he didn't come to DC looking for a job or to Marvel. What had happened was he'd been sending them copies of Alter Ego, and they liked what they were seeing enough that they invited him to come out. And he was kind of surprised that he had earned that. All throughout, he never really saw himself as, you know, DC needs me or Marvel needs me or I have these great things to add. He was just sort of always excited and pleased to have been invited to the table.
But, you know, Jeff, I want to add one more thing, that he was a bigger fan of Julius Schwartz.
Yeah.
So this is another thing that could have changed history. What if he had gone to DC and Julius Schwartz had been his mentor in training him? He would have stayed.
Yeah.
Except he hooked up with the son of Satan, and that's what happened.
How funny that you should say the phrase, what if, when discussing Roy Thomas, by the way. So he's now at Marvel. He's beginning to do some work there. Rob, could you give us a little bit more of what Roy was doing prior to the time that Stanley tapped him and goes, yeah, this guy, he can lead.
He wrote Avengers for a long time. He wrote X-Men. He was a science fiction fan, but he was aware of sword and sorcery literature and took a look, and he was enough of a comics professional to realize this stuff would work really well in comics. So he's the one who initiated Marvel getting into sword and sorcery and licensing Conan, after they tried licensing some other character first, but then they discovered that the rights to Conan weren't as expensive as they thought they were going to be. Because nobody I mean, Conan was published in a second-rate pulp magazine in the 1930s, and the number of people left who remembered them was dwindling. And
you have to keep things. You have to keep things in a public eye, or else it fades. You know, there's so many great things, great movies, great songs. Unless they're brought back periodically, it's just going to be gone to the sands of time. It's a shame in that sense.
Oh, Roy had a good run with Gene Colan on Doctor Strange in the 60s, and including the ill-advised mask version of Doctor Strange.
Oh, boy.
That didn't last long, but other than that, it looked pretty good.
Was that Roy's idea? Do you know?
It was under his watch, I think.
Sure, but under his watch. I always assumed it had been mandated.
I tell you what, no, he came up with it. He was writing a book. But I'll tell you this. When I was a kid, I thought the Doctor Strange with the mask and the one without the mask are two different people.
Couldn't blame you for thinking that.
I never connected that they were together, that he was him, because it seemed like when he put the mask on, all of a sudden he had big muscles. He was jacked. You know, he had this different thing. But, you know, without the mask, he kind of, you know, he's slight. Kind of a slight guy, little mustachio thing happening. I just saw them as two different people.
Yeah, the mask thing always seems so strange for me. Like, for any other hero, it makes sense. But Doctor Strange wasn't worried about, you know, criminals on the street recognizing him. He was worried about, like, you know, freaking Dormammu in a living tribunal. They knew who he was with a mask on. Like, it wasn't going to make a difference.
The real world answer is, that's a book that didn't sell. Yeah. So they figured they gave him a mask, he would be more superhero-y. And maybe people would like them more. They've done that with lots of characters over the history of comic books, where
yes,
if you're not connecting, you do something that people connect to. I remember years ago them saying, remember Jim Starlin's Dreadstar from the 80s?
Sure.
At the beginning of his existence, he used to have, his whole uniform was like a hoodie and a sword and just, you know.
Yeah, Starlin drew himself.
In their boots. Yeah.
He used himself as photo references.
Yeah, okay. So what happened is that when he had the series for Epic, Jim Starlin was told by Jim Shooter, of all people, that, well, maybe you should give him a superhero costume and that'll increase sales. And I don't think he wanted to do it, but he did it. And guess what? It increased sales.
Sure. So well, and again, one thing we'll have to talk
once
about
again, Jim Shooter knows what he's talking about. So.
Oh, boy. Eventually, we'll have to talk about Cadence / Perfect Films' involvement in all of this, but they certainly own Marvel by this point, and they're obviously, you know, concerned with licenses and merchandising. And I remember, you know, when I was a kid in the 80s, my first introduction to Doctor Strange was I had the Ben Cooper rubber bendy figures, and I had Batman and Superman and a couple others, and then I freaking had Doctor Strange, and I'm like, who the frick is this? Because he didn't have a mask on, he just looked like a dude wearing a blue dress in a cape.
He needed a mask, man. Come on, everybody should wear a mask.
So it was a merchandising decision. And that's why I was assuming the idea didn't come from Roy Thomas. Maybe it did, but I'd always assumed it didn't. But to get back to where you're going with this, Rob, you know, at first it sounds like what Roy is essentially doing is just, you know, becoming the stand-in. He doesn't like to give up, you know, his authorship responsibilities, but he finds that Roy is somebody who can write in this place, who respects his continuity, respects his visions, but Roy's not really standing out with anything he's doing yet. But I'm sure you have more to say, and I don't want to cut you off.
Well, by the time of the X-Men issues with Neil Adams, those were real standouts. Mm-hmm. The stories and the art together, it's like, wow, this team is something great.
Got a lot darker, didn't it?
Maybe, but it was a lot more interesting.
Yeah, a lot more complex. You had, you know, relationships, you know, with the question of Lorna Dane's paternal father. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm trying to remember, like, it's been a while since I've read that one, but there's some really rich stuff that I know that Claremont went back and sort of dug through again later on in Mind, because there were such great ideas left hanging, like, you know, Eric the Red and the living, what was it called again? The living...
Living Pharaoh.
Thank you. Living Pharaoh. Relationship with Havoc. Uh-huh. Sorry, Rob, I keep taking away from your steam. You keep going. I apologize.
No, it's okay. We're doing this together. and then that was... See, the X-Men issues with Neil were before I dropped out for a while. And then he started Conan with Barry Smith. Mm-hmm.
And of course that shocked the world.
And then in the early years of Conan were the same years he was writing the Kree-Skrull War.
Yeah. Oh boy. Oh boy.
Yeah. And you know, I've said before that if Marvel were run like DC, the Skrulls would have appeared once and never been mentioned again. Mm-hmm. That's the way DC did things. But in Marvel, they kept things around and developed them and made them more and more interesting. And the Kree-Skrull War was like, wow, of course, why they've got these star-spanning races that why wouldn't they run into each other? Right. They've both been here on Earth. What a great idea.
What a job. Rob,
you bring up a good point. You bring up a good point, Rob. They created the Skrulls in one story, and they created the Kree in another story. And until the Kree-Skrull War, they were not related in any way.
No.
They connected them as warring. And that was kind of, I like that. I like the continuity. And again, Roy Thomas was heir apparent to Stan Lee. He did do and connect things that kept them connected where you're guessing and you see the connectors later. And it's a fun thing. It makes the comic books fun. I mean, you know, you pointed out that DC wouldn't do things like that. That's why they got destroyed.
Yeah, and it was more than just that, too. It captured the same flavor that Fantastic Four 48 through 50 had. That overwhelming sense of you are part of something hopelessly larger than yourself. You know, whereas at DC, Superman is always the man. You know he's going to win. It's just a question of how long it's going to take. You know, you have the Avengers, Marvel's mightiest heroes, completely and totally pissing their pants in the middle of an interstellar war that is so much larger than them. And you can tell the story doesn't follow predictable plot points. Thomas is kind of making it up as he goes and throwing in twists and turns here and there. And more than that, too, you've also got public opinion turning against the Avengers. And suddenly they're having to defend their reputation, their character, and deep characterization with them at the same time. That storyline hit all the notes, all the buttons, everything great Stan and Jack had done at Marvel prior to that came back in a bigger way in that storyline.
Yeah, and they even called back Fantastic Four number 2 with the Skrulls that got hypnotized at the end. I mean,
the cows.
There's so many Easter eggs in there. You're like, wow, this is great, you know?
Yeah. And that's really what Roy did. I could actually agree that he didn't revolutionize things, but he built on what was there. And he built really well on what was there and made it, you know, bigger and better and greater as wherever he could. So,
well, all this is I hate to say this, guys, but all this is as a writer. Nothing to do with editing yet.
We haven't gotten him being editor yet,
editor in chief. No editor in chief stuff. We're talking about his reign as editor. So you're talking about his writing, which he's one of the greatest.
And just to clarify, I don't think his title was ever editor in chief, was it? He was just editor.
Yeah, they only had one editor then, so he was the editor.
Right. I don't think Stan ever would have tolerated the title editor-in-chief attached to somebody else.
Yeah.
Well, he was editor-in-chief. He was in charge of all the comic books the way Stan Lee was. Stan Lee stepped back a little bit.
Yeah.
That's another thing we'll talk about.
Well, he fits the criteria of an EIC, but he was just called editor.
Yeah, there wasn't any other editor to eventually they had assistant editors, but now Stan actually did stop writing before Roy became editor.
And then he came back at one point too.
It was a period when Jack Kirby left.
No, it was before that, I thought, wasn't it? And this happened various points. Stan became enamored with Hollywood and had this idea that he was going to break into Hollywood and have this, I forget the name, the movie had something to do with Monster was in the title. I know that. And he had this idea that he was going to take all the Marvel bullpen with him, you know, on his coattails. And then that sort of crashed and burned. I think he came back to write Marvel again for a while, but wasn't really exactly feeling it before he was finally offered the position of publisher.
Well, he actually did a screenplay that was bought here for $25,000, but it didn't go anywhere, like a lot of things in Hollywood don't go anywhere. But yeah, no, Roy Thomas is what you would call editor in chief, the guy in charge of all the comic books.
Yeah, it just wasn't the title he was actually given, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Paul Levitz and Dick Giordano, they weren't called editor in chief either. They were called something else, but they had the same type of job that our editor in chief does.
Well, so I mean, that actually sets us up for talking about him moving into the editor position, which is that Stan wanted to leave but didn't want to leave. He didn't want to do it anymore, but didn't want to surrender. Well, no, this isn't true. And Stan has said as much in interviews himself that he didn't want to leave behind his creations. He didn't want to put them in somebody else's hands, but he also didn't want to do it anymore. And so he gets the opportunity because he's become such an important public face of Marvel. When Cadence buys Marvel and takes over, one of their stipulations is that they need Stan Lee to stay on and be the face of Marvel. But they don't actually need him to write anything anymore. They just need him to be the one taking the credit, that that's important to them. And I don't say that flippantly, and I know the Kirby defenders and the Stan Lee haters are going to leap on that one. I have no agenda in saying that. It's a statement of good business. It's everyone thinks Stan Lee is Marvel. We need to keep that going if we want the Marvel brand to stay profitable. So Stan Lee stays in the offices. He has as much input as he wants to have, but he needs somebody else to make all the decisions and do all the hard work he doesn't want to do anymore. And so Roy Thomas is chosen to be a very different kind of editor than the editors who came after him, because he both is in charge and is not in charge. And in his own words, he was Stan's number two, and he likened himself to being Stan's foreman. Which is an awkward place to be. He has to make the tough decisions, but if Stan doesn't like those tough decisions, Roy's in trouble. So he's in charge, but he's also not in charge.
He might have been charged of the day-to-day stuff,
Sure.
but I
Yes, he
mean,
was.
what happened was that he would have to run things by Stan Lee. They said Stan Lee looked at every cover. So it was even in this
Well.
time. So he was still kind of had his hand in it.
Well, Martin Goodman used to look at covers too, didn't he? So,
Sometimes,
yeah.
occasionally.
Now, looking at the array of artists and writers, and when Roy took over, John Romita was still drawing Spider-Man. Engelhart and Sal Buscema were starting their incredible run on Captain America. Rich Buckler had just joined the Marvel Universe. They were doing Conan and Kull by the Severins, Daredevil by Gene Colan, Fantastic Four and Thor, John Buscema, Hulk by Herb Trimpe, Iron Man by George Tuska. And this is like the classic lineup of for all of these guys. They launched an Ant-Man series. Ant-Man had been gone for years, but they relaunched Doctor Strange with people like Barry Smith and Frank Brunner doing art. They launched Marvel team up with Gil Kane drawing it. Red Wolf with Sid Shores. Of course, I mentioned Bill Everett and Submariner. Tomb of Dracula started up with Gene Colan. And the Werewolf by Mike Ploog. And when I picture those characters in my head, those are the artists I see drawing them.
So, in your mind, Rob, you'd say that's sort of like the ideal, perfect lineup of Marvel was in place already when Roy stepped into editor position?
Pretty close to it, yeah.
Huh.
It just
It's
all
interesting because
classics here.
depending on who you talk to, Marvel was either, in its glory days, or it was a ship that was sinking quickly. And Roy is brought in and he has two very different expectations placed upon him. And one is, don't screw anything up. What we've got going is pretty good. And the other is, holy crud, you need to save everything. Roy will outright tell you he wasn't too in to Cadence's credit. It's always very tempting to paint any corporation that acquires a creative staff as the villain. And Cadence does a lot of things that aren't necessarily cool or groovy for the time period. But one thing that they do succeed in is they generally don't bother Roy Thomas with issues of money. It generally isn't a pressure that's placed upon him. They leave him to make creative decisions. They do limit him in some ways. We'll talk about the illusion of change in a moment, I'm sure. But generally speaking, Roy was free to do what he felt was appropriate as long as it didn't piss off Stan Lee.
And Roy was a good editor and let his artists and writers pretty much do what they wanted to do, once again, as long as it didn't piss off himself or Stan.
And there's where he faces a really unique challenge, which is here's where we talk about the illusion of change. For the core characters, the ones that, you know, Robbie just talked about, you know, were in their iconic mode, that there were T-shirts and posters being sold of, that's where Roy is told by Stan, and Roy decided later on, Stan said this on behalf of Cadence, that it came from them, the illusion of change. You can let it look like something big is going to happen. You can create high stakes as long as by the end of the issue, the status quo is restored. Nothing actually fundamentally changes. Because if Thor grows a beard, or Iron Man is replaced by a black man, or Spider-Man gets a black costume, I'm being facetious, of course. Those things would mess up the trademark. Then you couldn't sell the T-shirts anymore because that's not the character in the comic book. So those characters can't change anymore. And so Roy and Jerry Conway end up taking over ultimately most of those core titles as the old guard leaves. And then you have a whole new generation coming in, and they're the ones given the freedom. Because Roy was so heavily involved in the fandom, he had his first Friday meetings at his apartment where prominent voices who were coming up in the fandom and people who wanted to be artists and wanted to be writers were regularly at his apartment and meeting and discussing things. He was able to hand pick the next generation of creative wizards for Marvel and give them titles nobody cared about and say, do whatever the hell you want to. And that was a whole other, here's a quote I have. This came from Starlin. I love this. Starlin says that Roy Thomas said to him, quote, "I don't have time to edit. So we're hiring you to write this book. If you can turn it on time and can make it sell, you can keep doing it. If you can't, then we'll fire you and hire somebody else." In short, I'm not watching. Nobody's watching. Don't screw up.
He said the same thing to Steve Englehart, actually.
Did he really?
Look, you got the book. Yeah, you got the book. If it don't sell, we're just going to fire you.
Oh, that's fantastic. That is fantastic.
But you know, Jeff, there's a downside to that.
Oh, I was waiting for it.
He opened up the genie's bottle and let the genie out, and they had a hard time putting it back in. If you tell somebody, here's the book, write it, you're essentially your own editor, then okay, yeah, you'll get somebody doing some nice stuff, but then you'll get crap sometimes too, and you'll get people doing less than their best because they know, hey, nobody's checking over my shoulder, so I'm just going to do whatever I want. And that, yeah, they had to try to put the genie back in a bottle for years after that. Not even before Jim Shooter came, he gets the blame for trying to stop the writer editor thing. But all of them wanted that stopped. Well, and Roy Thomas is the one that started it.
Jim Shooter gets credit for stabilizing Marvel, but I think a lot of that credit actually goes to Archie Goodwin, who preceded him. And I think Roy had a pretty high percentage of success with the stuff where he just said, here's a book that nobody cares about, go do something. It was a pretty high percentage of success with those.
Yeah.
I don't know about that. You have to point out to me the books that he said told people to do, and it stayed successful the whole way. I know that Steve Englehart, he revolutionized Captain America and made it something really good. But the other people, they came and went.
Well, I don't think that's fair.
I mean, point out some books that maybe I'm wrong. Just point out some books to me that he said, here, take this over. And it became something special for the long run.
Gerber, Howard the Duck and Man Thing. Starlin, the whole Thanos saga. Doug Mensch, Planet of the Apes and Shang-Chi. Steve Englehart and Doctor Strange that he did was incredible. Don McGregor and Black Panther. So many great things.
A lot of those things you mentioned are short-lived.
Yes.
The Captain Marvel thing left. I mean, Jim Starlin, I love Jim Starlin, but he's kind of like moody, you know. He gets offended right away, and he quits.
Well, and here's the problem, too, is they were having was the comic market was in serious trouble even at this point. And that's for a lot of reasons, but one of them is that, you know, entertainment had become a lot more accessible to kids. you now had TV and children's programming, and you had toys were getting more cool. Even board games were getting more exciting, where comic books were not really all that you had anymore. So that they had to start targeting an older audience. And what was happening was, and I think this is part of why Roy Thomas, for better and worse, felt he could trust these people. He knew these creators. He knew them as fans. He wasn't bringing in strangers who just passed a test. These are people he had at his dining room table. And so he knew they had great ideas and were doing the kind of things that the older fandom wanted to see. And while it didn't make the big bucks the way, Star Wars and Conan did, which we'll talk about in a bit, what it did do was I think it kept comicdom alive for a while. It kept the energized, motivated fan base out there continuing to support Marvel and continuing to come back to comic books.
Yeah, people like me. This stuff was aimed at me.
And I will honestly say my favorite era of comics is absolutely Marvel between 72 and 74, specifically stuff written by those new guys that Thomas brought in. That's what I love.
Yeah. And even things that didn't last a long time were either very good or, in some cases, very interesting while they lasted.
And I think it's important to also capture, that really one thing that happened under Roy was, you have Marvel expanding exponentially, and there's Stan Lee still, being the public face of it and asking Roy, do everything I used to do. And Roy's going, wait, there's a lot more here now, and trying to figure out how to delegate and how to make sure everything's getting done without doing it all himself, while also realizing any decision he makes can be shot down by Stan Lee at any given moment. So
That was a shame.
he certainly had a very overwhelming job in front of him. But I just to go back again to a moment of, man, we are absolutely going to debate back and forth whether his laissez-faire attitude of do what you want was positive or negative. And I think the answer ultimately will be both. But one thing Marv Wolfman said that I always liked, here's a quote: Roy was very open to ideas and allowed you to do almost anything. He managed to find ways to get you into the company before you knew you were there. Because he was giving people carte blanche opportunities, do what you want to do, as long as it's not one of the major established titles. That what person coming up knew who wanted to get into comics was going to say no to that? Write what you want to write, no questions asked, as long as you don't piss off Stan Lee, as long as it sells books and it's on time.
And it
Great
passes the
deal.
comics code.
Sure, right. And
Now,
this is a great one too. This is from John Romita. And it just goes to show what the culture Roy Thomas had created. He said, Starlin turned down the Fantastic Four, and that was the first time I ever heard of a professional comic artist. They used to be so grateful to get a steady book, they would crawl on their bellies. Turned down a book. He said he didn't want to be tied down to it. It got to a point where you didn't want the crusty old Marvel titles. You didn't want Fantastic Four. You didn't want Thor, Iron Man, because you had to keep doing the predictable because of the illusion of change. But if you want to take on Kazar, the frick is Kazar? Do what you want. Have fun with it.
I interpreted that differently. I didn't feel like, I felt like at that point Jim Starlin was already, they kind of screwed around with him already. And so when they asked him to do Fantastic Four, it was almost like a F you, I'm not doing anything, that type of thing. I was kind of shocked that I heard he was offered Fantastic Four. What a different universe it would have been to see him do Fantastic Four. I mean, he would have brought Thanos in and everyone else.
But he never
You
would have,
know he would
because
have.
he was having deep conversations about what is the nature of God under waterfalls, with other Marvel talent, and then coming over and sprinkling that into his comic books. You couldn't put that in Fantastic Four.
Well, don't leave out all the drug use too.
Oh yeah. Well, one of the best story I was rereading Marvel Comics: The Untold Story by Sean Howe in preparation for this. And one of my favorite anecdotes is you've got Starlin, you've got Frank Brunner drinking endless wine and having endless edibles while doing planning sessions together. And Starlin is still able to come in before deadline with great work each time. And Frank Brunner's just getting high as frick and not getting anything done and basically washes out of the company because he can't handle the kind of stuff Starlin is doing. And that's the thing too, is Roy Thomas had to turn a blind eye to that. There's stories that basically people like lying down on the floor in the offices, just getting high off their butts, And there's Roy Thomas's office pretending he doesn't see it because, you know, hey, we're writing good books, so they're getting out in time.
Yep. If you meet your deadlines, you can do just about anything.
And that leads to a problem too, is that, you know, because Stan Lee is still number one, because he's still making the big calls and he frequently undermines Roy Thomas, who doesn't like a decision he made. Or in fact, Thomas claims there are many times that Stan Lee would approve an idea. And then the president of the company would say, "What, you can't do this." Al Lando. Landau, Landu, Lando, Landau, not Lando.
Landau
That's
Calrissian.
I was gonna say. So Al Landau would, you know, say like you can't do this. And Stan Lee would be like, "Yeah, Roy, you can't do this." And
Yeah.
not only was it a betrayal, because you know, Roy had been loyal to Stan and you know, all of that, but on top of that too, it hurt his credibility in the offices. Where you know people didn't respect him because they could see that he wasn't the one making the big decisions. He was cowering under Lee and Landau. He wasn't empowered. So he often felt they didn't respect him as a boss, so he had to be laid back. He couldn't pull a shooter. He was being constantly undermined. You know, one big episode that really upset him was his wife had applied for a job there, or rather, Stanley had promised her a job. And then one day when Roy wasn't there, they basically everyone in the office agreed they weren't going to give her the job because they thought she'd be a spy for Roy. And so she'd get the job and she was furious at Roy. It hurt their marriage irreparably because she wanted Roy to go in and fight for her. And he couldn't do that because he wasn't the big boss. You know, or
It
like,
killed it.
yeah,
It
or
killed his marriage.
George, tell me you know about the Vince Coletta anecdote.
I heard that. I mean, and you know what? This story has been attributed to so many different
I
people.
think it just
It's
happened
like,
so many different times, George.
I guess
It
they
just
think that
happened that many times.
something happened with Vince Coletta. I think they were taking him off. Roy Thomas was taking Vince Coletta off the Thor book,
Yes,
and
he.
supposedly Vince Coletta came in the office and threatened to throw him out a window.
Yup. Fortunately, Roy was a good sweet talker, so he was able to work it out with him, but. What happened was Conway and Coletta were not, you know, clicking, and Conway said, "Listen, this is making me uncomfortable, whatever." So Roy got him off the book, and Coletta just knew. Coletta never would have said that to Stan Lee, but you know, and I know, you know, George, you talk about mafia ties in a moment, but he walks in and just says, "I'm going to throw you out the freaking window," and you know that hurt Roy too because he's like, "Wow, they feel they can talk to me like that, and I have no power to back me up." Al Landau is not going to say, "You can't talk to Roy Thomas like that." But the big one that really messed Roy up, and this is where my heart really goes out to him, because you got to remember that Roy was a fan first and foremost. And I truly believe Stan was ready to leave the company. If it hadn't been for Roy, I think Marvel would have died. I don't think anybody else would have stepped in who could fulfill Stan's vision and work under the unrealistic expectations Stan had of do all of my work, but also I overrule you and I get the credit. I think Marvel would have washed up. And then you've got the death of Gwen Stacy. Which, according to Roy Thomas, they presented the idea to Stan first. Stan said, "Fine, do whatever you want. I don't write the book anyway. I don't care." And then fans were up in arms about it. And when they complained to Stan, Stan threw Roy under the bus and claimed they never ran it by me. They snuck it in when I wasn't paying attention, or they snuck it in behind my back. And Roy outright said he didn't feel he could go to conventions after that. Fans were furious with him. They saw him as a bad guy, and he lost that connection that had been so important to him. And I think that's another betrayal he never quite recovered from. So, you know, on the one hand, you can say, you know, you asked earlier on, George, what would Roy have been like if he'd gotten the job at DC instead? You know, if he had worked under Mort Weisinger or someone else, he might have been a very different editor. But I would argue, on the one hand, he was a nice guy, you know, who liked to get along with people, was very affable, very friendly. But also because of the situation Stanley had painted him into, he couldn't go in and exert his authority because he had none. He couldn't tell people what to do because they could run into Stan's office and do a runaround and have Stan come down on him in a second. He had to be laid back and give them freedom. In the books where there needed to be tight editorial control, he wrote those himself or trusted Jerry Conway to do it.
My understanding was that also because of his age, there were people that had been at Marvel that didn't respect him. In other words, who's this young punk coming in telling me what to do? It
That's
wasn't
true.
just about Stan Lee, it was an age thing.
And he
So,
brought in a bunch of young punks with him, too. Don't forget that.
very
Even
young. I
younger
think
punks.
Conway was like 17, and I
Yeah.
mean, these guys are young people, you're right.
Well, there's a Starenko story where I guess Stanley had agreed to give Steranko an interview for a job. And Steranko shows up, in total Steranko style. And Stanley looks up the door and goes, "Get this guy out of here. I'm not meeting with this guy." And Roy's the one who looked at his artwork and said, no, you got to give this guy a job and fought for him. And, I got to imagine if I was an old guy working in an office where Steranko comes parading in with the shades and and the jackets and the cool and all that stuff, I'd be like, what is this office coming to?
Nobody likes change, I guess. You like what you like.
Roy couldn't have stayed away from conventions for very long because I talked to him at a couple of conventions in the 70s.
I don't think Roy Thomas held grudges. I don't think he held
No,
grudges.
in Stan's final months, Roy Thomas was there taking pictures with him and smiling, and he was really hurt and betrayed by Stan. But for him to be able to talk about this and to have felt that level of betrayal, I'm glad to hear he did ultimately go back. That makes me happy, Rob. But it had to hurt to have the fans turn against him like that when he had done everything right. It was an impossible situation where no matter what he did, time and again, he was going to get thrown under the bus. And that's
Yeah,
hard.
but fans, like grow up, you're gonna be yelling about some fictional character dying, what, 10 years later?
Isn't it refreshing
Grow
to know that fandom has always been toxic? That's not
up.
new. Before the internet, they still sucked ass. Championing Gwen Stacy. Oh my gosh. Anyway,
Speaking,
go
that
ahead.
reminds me, the first few months that Roy was editor, they introduced three different issues with female protagonists in
Yes.
three different genres. We had a superhero, the Cat, we had a jungle story with Shauna the She-Devil, and a dramatic, maybe even romance story with Night Nurse. And there hadn't been comics with female protagonists other than Wonder Woman in a long time.
And they were all
Yes.
written by women, which was bold because there were no women writing in the Marvel bullpen at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the
So.
Fix was kind of in on that. They said that, first of all, one of the books is being written by his wife. The second book is being written by Phil Stuhling's wife. And there was another woman that wrote it, but it's like they just like shoved people in, like almost like it was a gimmick or like a stunt.
Well, if you decide that you want unique female voices and it's 1970 or 1970, what year are we in right now?
72.
72. There are no women right now. Right, there's women drawing in comics, but there's no women writing in comics right now. Where are you going to go? So you ask women who are in the who are comic adjacent, who
But they
know
weren't
the.
professionals. It's like they just got people in and just shoved them. Okay, here, like make
Right.
believe you're a good writer.
But
You weren't
how
sitting
do you
a
become a
woman is here.
professional? You get
Right.
professional by having an
But
experience.
they weren't trying to be professionals. What I'm trying to say is like they pull somebody off the street and said, "Oh yeah, you're a woman, you got two breasts? Okay, yeah, could you write this book?"
But they
No,
were
they
comic.
did not do that.
No, these were women who were comic adjacent. They were aware of the industry. They were by default part of the industry, but through association, they knew these characters. They presumably cared about them enough that Roy felt they could do a reasonably good job. And those comics are not horrifically bad. You can argue they're not great, certainly, but they're not amateur. They're not awful. They're competent.
You know what cracked me up? I think one of the books is The Cat,
Yes.
right? It said that Wally Wood was drawing the women like
Oh
totally
God,
nude,
yes.
with nipples blaring and everything.
Which was a way of telling the women, you're not welcome here, go home. And it worked, unfortunately. But I got to
Yeah.
say one other thing, George. I got to call the hypocrite alarm on you for a second. You're saying that these women, it was who they knew. They weren't experts in the industry. They were brought in just because they were someone's wife. But how do you think Stan Lee got hired?
Stanley was a writer. These people were not writers. Come on, man. It's
Stanley
apples and
just
oranges,
graduated from
dude.
high school.
He was a writer. He was doing well. I mean, look, he started somewhere, but these people here would never aspire to be writers. They were
How do
just
you know
brought
that?
in. One of them
How do you know
was.
that?
One of them was. But the other two, Phil Suling's wife, what did she ever write before or after that?
But what did Stan Lee write before that?
He wanted to be a writer from the get-go. Is
How do
it
you know
apples
that
and
she didn't?
oranges? I don't know. I have to go in my time machine and interview
That would be awesome. I'm coming with you.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Wally Wood's drawing nude pictures of Stanley and sending them back to him. It was hard. It was really, really hard if you were a woman who cared about comics and actually wanted to be in any way involved in the industry back then. It was really hard. And, both companies did a lot to make women feel unwelcome, that if they were aspiring writers, they still weren't going to try because they knew they weren't going to get a fair shake. Even when you were someone important's wife, Roy Thomas's or Phil Soulings, even when you had that level of connection and the editor himself said, "You write this," Wally Wood was still going to sexually harass you with drawings.
You know, Jeff, I can't believe we disagree on this one. There was a stunt. It wasn't a genuine. They didn't go out there and say, we need to find women writers to do these books. They just went, oh, you're my wife. Yeah, you do this. Oh, yeah, okay. Phil Soling, yeah, I like. Okay, your wife could draw it. Do this.
There
It wasn't a genuine effort.
was no pipeline back then.
Come on, stick to the point. Roy Thomas, right? What did he ever create? What did he ever do
Well,
as an editor besides let people smoke pot on the ground and turn in late books?
so one of the huge things that Roy is doing is bringing in all these new young creators, which Stan was not doing. And in fact, Roy was actually really good at talking people into coming back who didn't want to work there. He was able to bring back Len Wein after a number of years. When Starlin was ready to walk, he made Starlin stay a little bit longer, and then Starlin left in a huff again. But and also his network with that Stan upset tremendously. His network with the fandom, his connections with these people in the fandom allowed him to handpick these amazing young talents that DC didn't even know existed. His recruiting game was top notch. If this were baseball, Roy Thomas was the Marvel farm system.
Okay,
This
that's
is
legit. That's legit. He got good guys in there. All right.
nice.
Oh, you know who started working for Marvel around this time? Ross Andrew. He did the first few issues of Doc Savage before he took over Spider-Man. Yeah.
He brought in Cochran, didn't he? He brought in Englehart.
I
He brought
think
in
so.
before he was editor, but he helped with
Yeah.
that. McGregor, Isabella, Mensch. He couldn't
Yeah.
have possibly known what Claremont was going to go on to do. He just brought him in to be an assistant editor, but technically he hired Claremont as well.
Yeah,
Lots of good people.
let's not forget that Roy Thomas also created Wolverine.
I wanted to talk about that controversy because even Roy Thomas laughs when people say that and says, "What part of Wolverine did I create?"
That's not true. Do you ever heard the newest story that he said that they're putting him on the new movie as co-creator of Wolverine
Oh,
because
I
he's the
know.
one that lobbied for it. But the point
Well,
is that it's creating a big fight because Len Wein's a widow is saying, well, that's stolen valor.
in
He didn't
Roy
write
Thomas,
it at all.
he's literally laughing uncomfortably in interviews right now, and people are asking if he created Wolverine and saying, "No, I didn't." But what he did do was he went to Len Wein and he said, "I want you to create a Canadian hero named Wolverine." And that was the full extent of his involvement in that. So he did say, "Make him Canadian." He did say, "Call him Wolverine." He did say, "Create a character." So theoretically, there wouldn't be a Wolverine if it hadn't been for him. But I would also argue that this is a whole mess. Len Wein made Wolverine a wisecracking guy who gets knocked out by, gas, and his powers are described as being super fast. So I would argue in many ways he didn't create Wolverine either. It was really what Claremont and Miller did later on that made Wolverine who he is. But no one cares about that. Rob Liefeld created Deadpool, end of story. It's stupid. It's stupid.
Well, and Stan Lee said to Steve Ditko, I want a spider themed character who's a teenager.
Right.
Everything else was Ditko, so who created it?
Bob Kane created Batman, right?
This is the eternal question whenever it comes to comic books. It's probably the only genre, only business where you have this division of who created what. I mean, you say Rob Liefeld, but from what he said, from what he said, he would bring entire characters fully made and said, this is the character.
That's not the case of Deadpool at all, not even remotely.
That's what he said. That's the case.
I
That's what he
know it's
said.
what he says. I
He
and I he
actually
slams.
sold the character to Marvel with a contract and everything, and he gets a piece to the action.
Well, he
No one
slams.
else is getting a piece of that action.
He bullies people online who also claim that he didn't invent Deadpool. But the fact of the matter is, Deadpool was a very blatant ripoff of Slade Wilson from New Teen Titans. And beyond that, he had no personality. He was a badass assassin. He wasn't wisecracking. He wasn't breaking the fourth wall. All the things people love about Deadpool, none of that came from Rob Liefeld. That was done later on. But it's not the point. You know, we live in a culture where people obsess over first appearances, and that's why we look at it that way. Who created that first appearance? But the first appearance
Well,
isn't often what made the character endearing.
I remember we had some discussion about the creation of Deathlok.
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah, it was Rich Buckler's character and story, and Doug Munch was assigned
Flesh it out.
to flesh it out and do the dialogue. So, did he co-create the character?
And
Well,
Rich Buckler himself went back and forth on that one.
yeah.
He did. And
Now,
it was a huge thing. He was furious at Mensch and wouldn't talk to him, but other times he'd absolutely say, "Oh yeah, it was my idea first, but Mensch was a co-creator for sure."
well,
You
getting back
said there
to
was.
Wolverine for a second. I'm sorry. Going back to Wolverine for a second. Trimpy is a friend who one who actually drew him first in a story, but he's not even credited as a creator.
I didn't know that. He's
It's
not credited as a co-creator?
Romita, Len Wein, and Roy Thomas.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
So how does that work?
I don't know. This is the
Well,
first I'm hearing of that.
Romita probably designed the costume.
he designed the character.
Oh,
And they said
okay.
Len Wein came up with the name. Well, I don't I, again it's you know it, this is something that I kind of meant to ask about this whole creation thing. If you allow me to go off on a tangent a little bit. I've heard from DC that Julius Schwartz, editor, mostly an editor, would run ideas past people, give them subjects to do. So was he the editor or was he co-creator to a lot of these things? I
See,
never
now
get
see.
hear him. I never hear him credited as a writer of or originator of certain ideas, but he would like shape it with the writer.
Yeah, I don't know. And
Yeah.
I can tell you that, you know, going back to Roy Thomas with that idea, Roy Thomas was often helping to generate a lot of the ideas for the new characters and properties turned out at this time. Not Deathlok, but a lot of the others, he was there in the room working on the idea with them and just said, "I don't have time to write this. You take it instead." So even
Yeah,
though, like,
that's what I'm saying. So I don't
yeah.
know.
All right. So
So.
speaking of positive things that Roy Thomas did at Marvel, you know, another big thing he did was advocating for those who couldn't speak for themselves. And a lot of that was, you know, how he ended up on Al Landau's hit list. You know, one of his most famous stories of this is that Al Landau had someone who came in who was pitching the idea that in order to make more money off of these comics in an age where comics become less profitable, she'd figured out that when you turn a page, the reader's attention goes first to the right-hand page. So she wanted all the right-hand pages in Marvel Comics to be full-page ads. And Roy Thomas said, "Are you flipping kidding me? You do that, we're going to lose money because everyone's going to stop reading our comics. You can't do that to the readers." And he won that battle, but you know, didn't win much grace with Al Landau, who was there to make money. And then, you know, obviously the big thing, well, maybe I shouldn't get into that one yet, what caused him to finally step down. Let me save that for now. Why don't we talk
Yeah.
about the other big things that we need to address? You talked a bit, Rob, before about Conan, and I don't know if we've done that enough justice yet about what a game changer that was.
It was. I'm looking right now at the cover of issue 24 of The Song of Red Sonja, which has got to be one of the greatest single issues ever published. Yeah, what Roy and Barry Smith did there was just electric and different from anything that any other, certainly any other company was doing. Although I think Gold Key, of all people, had some kind of a sword and sorcery series going at the time. But Gold Key was like completely off my radar. Conan, and it had to have been popular because pretty soon afterward, you had Kull. And of course, Gulliver Jones didn't last all that long, and he was replaced in Creatures on the Loose by Thongor, Lynn Carter's character, who also didn't last very long. But there was a little Easter egg, I guess, in a Thongor story that I should tell you about soon. Yeah, Conan, he really put the character back on the map, and
Sure.
the cultural map, that and the paperback books at the same time.
You know, even we were just having a conversation before about how ludicrous his masked Doctor Strange was. You know,
Yes.
this idea of taking this mystical character who's not quite a superhero and trying to stick him back into the mold that presumably Cadence wanted. And Conan is flying right in the opposite direction. And Stanley even said, "This guy wasn't wearing a costume. Why wasn't he wearing a costume? I had no time for this. I thought it was going to fail." You know, it was common sense said, "This is not safe. This is not something we can throw on a t-shirt." And he proved them wrong and really blew open the floodgates of comicdom in the 70s. Because while DC had already been stepping outside of the superhero genre, you know, 1968, they were already doing, you know, House of Mystery as horror again, and, you know, bringing back anthologies and experimenting with different genres a bit. Roy wanted to take these new genres and not just do anthology titles. He wanted to give you characters and ongoing stories you would care about and come back to again and again, much like was done with the Marvel heroes and these other genres. And he saw the potential for Conan to be exactly that. To this day, I struggle. I didn't think I was going to like Conan before I read him for the first time. And I love Conan now. I do. And ironically enough, I enjoy Thomas's comics even more than I enjoy the original stories. I really do. I think because he adds that fanboy need to connect the history together and make it all somehow linear, which, you know, Elsebreak Camp did too, but I get beside myself. The point is that even when I'm not reading Conan, I struggle to explain to myself why I could possibly be interested in that title. But you just have to read it. I'm sorry, Rob, you were in a thing, and once again, I took you off track. I just had to insert
It's
that.
okay. Yeah, and it was a little different in the 70s when they see Marvel House ads, and they would have the usual suspects. They'd show the Captain America and Spider-Man and the Hulk and the Thing, and then suddenly you also had Conan and Dracula. It's like, wait a minute. That's something different here. Did they eventually decide that Dracula actually does exist in the Marvel universe with all the superheroes?
Oh yeah, George was a big fan of this. He loved it.
Not. I mean, Dracula was cool, you know, but I think I mentioned this in a podcast earlier. I don't think it works when you put a supernatural horror characters with superheroes because it's no match.
Episode three, if you want to go back and hear it.
I want to add something about Conan. Even Roy Thomas didn't know how big of a hit this thing was going to
Oh
be.
no.
I think that Conan might have been the top selling book they had. If you
I
put
don't know.
together the magazine, they said the sales are unbelievable in the magazine.
And you know, Roy Thomas, he often wasn't bothered with sales news, good or bad. Al Landau didn't usually tell him when he was losing money, and he didn't come in and say, "Hey, you made us a bunch of money either." Actually, was Al Landau even in charge when the Conan thing happened? It might have been his predecessor at that point. But anyway, the point being that, and I think also it's you know, Thomas's humility, you know, because he's not arrogant, he's not a braggart, he's not full of himself. He's like, "Hey, maybe this will work."
And God, the art that they got there, Barry Smith turned into this incredible stylist. And this is, I guess, the era when, in my head as a fan, I was seeing a lot of the superhero stories were kind of generic Marvel superhero art. When some of the books, the artists were really distinct stylists who were not trying to do generic superhero art. And Barry Smith was definitely one of them. And Mike Ploog, as I mentioned, was another one. You're not going to mistake his stuff for anybody else.
Certainly
And
not.
yeah,
Well,
the
Barry Smith's artwork evolved because at the beginning it was a Kirby clone. If you look
yes,
at his
yes.
Avengers work and his X-Men work and a few other things he did, he was just copying Jack Kirby. But you are right in this, that when he did Conan, he like leaped. I mean, the changes were so unbelievable from one issue to the next
You
that
could
it
see it
became
start to happen in his Khazar stories. in early issues of Astonishing Tales. Oh, and then along with that, with Barry Smith, the Severin siblings on Kull, was absolutely incredible work. Yeah, with Thongor, they tried Val Mayerik on the art, and I might as well tell you the story now. The last few Thongor stories were Vicente Alcazar, who had just recently arrived in the United States, and he somehow hooked up with Neil Adams, and Neil helped him get established in the U.S. comics industry. And in a panel in Creatures on the Loose, number 29, there is a message written backwards in Spanish at the bottom of the panel that says, "Esta viñeta se la dedico a Neil." This panel I dedicate to Neil. And Roy was the official editor of that book, and he never saw that. He didn't know about it.
And maybe he didn't know Spanish, so maybe if he saw it, he wouldn't know what the hell it was.
But I saw it. I noticed it in 1974. And in, what was it, like 2008, I think, Roy came up to the Emerald City Convention in Seattle, and Kurt and I went there, and I showed it to him. And he said, "Wow, that's really cool." And he mentioned at the time that Stan had really discouraged that kind of thing. He didn't like that, those secret messages from the artists putting in there, but Roy thought it was kind of fun. So he wasn't unhappy that it had happened. And he asked me to send him a scan of it, which I did, and he printed it in Alter Ego.
All right, so back to Roy Thomas' decisions that he made as editor. The last big one we need to cover for sure, we have to talk about Star Wars.
It saved Marvel. And maybe saved all of comics. How about that?
That's certainly Jim Shooter's belief. And Roy Thomas said that Shooter told me that, and that was nice of him. I didn't know that. Sure.
Yeah, that thing made so much money. It's unbelievable. They said they kept reprinting and reprinting, and they said they actually put Marvel in the black. Yeah, they said that it gave him a chance to catch up and start doing good stuff and start blowing all the money with doing it before he came along.
And as always, Roy did not realize what a big deal Star Wars was going to be. In fact, he was told repeatedly by people in the office, "This is going to lose money. What are you doing?" But, you know, he was looking to innovate. You know, superheroes were stale, and there was only so much he could do with the old stable of characters. He was looking to get into new stuff, and Star Wars was new and exciting, and even if it flopped, it was going to be an adventure.
Yep.
Well, they thought it was just space ray guns and stuff that you've seen a million times in comic books. So they didn't think, I mean, really, who could have predicted anything about Star Wars or what it's done to this culture since?
Oh. And I'll tell you, I think Roy undersells himself a bit too, because I think he was following where the mainstream zeitgeist was. My gosh, Prince Hal would make fun of me for using that word again. But you know, here's the thing. It wasn't just Star Wars either. You know, he prior to that secured the license to Planet of the Apes, which prior to Star Wars was the largest mass merchandising big budget franchise there had ever been. And he made sure that Marvel was writing those stories. And I don't think he could have guessed that Star Wars was going to be as big. But, you know, certainly before the movie came out, they were licensing toys. You know, they were making big multimedia arrangements. They were planning for Star Wars to be a sizable deal. And he was there to make sure Marvel was a part of it.
Yeah. Planet of the Apes, man. The only good human is a dead human.
George, I think you still think that. The point just being that I think Roy's imagination was big. And I think also, credit to Cadence, credit to, as much as Al Landau I'm going to paint as a total villain in a few minutes' time, credit to him at least.
You painted him that. We don't know the guy.
I said me. But you know,
I heard he treated his mother very well. So anyway,
what are you doing with Al Landau's mother? Anyway, so I think that the fact that he was given the freedom to do these things, you know, that as long as he wasn't rocking the boat, You know, he had the freedom to invest some of Marvel's money into a licensing deal. You know, he could go and he could hire new people and he could start new titles, and no one really questioned him as long as it didn't upset anything. And, you know, praise to Roy Thomas for starting the Star Wars comic book, but praise also to everyone above him who got out of his way and let that happen. As much as I think that one of the best and worst things Roy Thomas did was have a laid-back approach in how he ran his office, there was also a laid-back approach to people above him who were watching him.
You know, I think I changed my mind. He did contribute a lot. He did.
Woohoo!
He was. You know what? I mean, I'm not too big to admit when I, you know, I, maybe I was
Oh,
wrong.
George, just for that big admission, I'm going to draw a picture of you nude, okay?
Isn't that nice? Bless your heart. You know, I'm inclined to think, and this might be my tinfoil hat theory.
Oh boy.
Tinfoil hat theories.
But maybe it's not so far-fetched. You know why he instituted the you write it, you can edit it yourself. You know, maybe you want to say, okay, you know, he was giving them their freedom and he trusted them. But I mean, there was a lot of people he didn't really know. He was trusting people that shouldn't have trust yet. They didn't prove anything. The reason why is because he was writing a million books a month.
Yes,
A million.
I don't
If
think
you
you'll get any
look at it,
disagreement from us on that one. That, you
look at
know,
it, look at his output in those years. There's no way he could have been editing everything or being so in charge and also write those books at the same time.
well, that was the line. I don't have the time to edit, so we're hiring you to write this book.
Yeah, so I could write my books.
Absolutely,
Yeah.
and you know, it's after him they start doing the assistant editor concept. You know, at that point the idea still was, well, Stan did it. You know, when they had a
Yeah,
dozen
there's a
titles, now you
only
do it
one
now that we
editor.
have three times that.
Yeah.
Well, the
So.
problem is that, you know, once somebody gets away with something, then it gets worse and worse and worse. So people editing their books, maybe Steve Englehart did it okay at the beginning and a few of the other people, but then after a while, you're
Yeah.
just putting any piece of crap together and you don't care if the story makes sense at all, and who's going to tell you anything?
Well, and that was Jerry
Yeah.
Conway.
This is the era when Englehart was writing Avengers with the Celestial Madonna stories.
God, that was amazing.
But
And
then he started missing deadlines and he
yeah,
started not putting out the work. So
wait, and
you
there's
need an
the
editor sometimes to knock on the door and say, hey guy, where's the script?
well, there's the double-edged sword of it is, yes, some people absolutely were abusing it, no doubt about that. And some people were creating some of the most innovative out there work that you never would have seen at any other time in any other publisher, because there were no restrictions other than very, very basic ones. Because Roy trusted them, they could do whatever. It's like my Doug Mensch. You know, I first fell in love with Mensch's work on Planet of the Apes. And what I love about that is there are so many Planet of the Apes comics that have been made over the years.
The only good human is a dead human.
Thank you.
I've
His is
heard that
the
somewhere
only
before.
one that doesn't give an F what happened in the movies. He's not trying to connect it to the movies at all. He's just like, okay, cool premise. Now let's meet these totally new characters doing totally new things. Let's have people climbing out of George Washington's nose at Mount Rushmore. Let's have psychotropic alien torture machines. Let's have mutant brains controlling drones. Like, it was just whatever the heck he wanted, because nobody was coming in and saying, excuse me, this is not what Planet of the Apes is supposed to be. So he made whatever he wanted to.
Yeah,
Jeff,
why not?
Jeff, I think I have to read that series now.
Yeah, you do. I mean, even Kilraven,
Just
which I
can't, I want to see an ape come out of somebody's nose.
oh, that's a real issue. It's called Up the Nose Tube to Monkey Trash. That's the title of the issue. That is literally what it's called. But even Kilraven was supposed to be War of the Worlds licensing. And you know, Don McGregor took it in some wacky places that were marginally adjacent to War of the Worlds. Barely. You know, it Shang-Chi came out of a it partially came out of, you know, liking the Kung Fu TV series, but also it was this the Sax Rohmer license
Yep, Manchu.
to Fu Manchu. And you know, Fu Manchu is it's not the Fu Manchu stories at all. And nobody said, excuse me, this is not the Fu Manchu stories. It was do what you want to do, take it where you want to. And
Yep.
yeah, you it's and George, you've been kind not bringing up the stealing. You know, that was happening too, because nobody was watching the helm. A lot of shady things were happening there, but also some really great comics were being made at the same time.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, it was a good period. I mean, the creativity is fantastic, of course. But, you know, again, you open the Pandora's box now.
Yeah. How do you?
A lot of stuff's been happening that later on you have to say, well, we're going out of business because of this stuff.
And I don't know that I agree that that was driving them out of business, but I will say this. I think when you are in a leadership position, it is far easier to give people something than to take something away from people. And he, in a way, set up Shooter to fail later on because somebody was eventually going to have to say, excuse me, you can't all be your own editors. This is not going to work.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if the output continued, it would have been okay. But again, people like Steve Englehart, at the end, they were taking off 5 books and delivering like 3. And you can't have that.
And that, you know, you didn't need Shooter for that because John Verporten was already doing that. John Verporten, even Roy Thomas was afraid of John Verporten. You know, he was the productions guy, and he was offered the opportunity to be editor prior to Roy Thomas. He didn't want it. He was just happy to make sure things happened. And you did not want his wrath. If you were falling behind in deadlines, he was knocking on your door. And
you know what, Jeff? You're incorrect about that. John Verporten was letting them get away with murder. A lot of the time when people had to produce work, he was doing it for them.
Well, I don't know if that's letting him get away with it. I think it's got to get done one way or the other.
Yeah, but he was letting people steal. In other words, they were getting paid for the work, and when they didn't do the work, he did it.
Well, he didn't get to take back their checks. He didn't have that power. He could yell at them. He could report them. You know, but at the end of the day, the work had to get published. That's not him being a nice guy. That's do your freaking job. Okay, you're not doing it. I'll freaking do it. But I'm going to go tell Roy or Stan or Al about this. And then it's on them to do something or not do something.
He didn't do that. He didn't do that last part.
How do you know?
Because that's what Jim Shooter said when he came in. He said that there was all kinds of stuff that people were taking vouchers for that they didn't produce.
But that's not necessarily on Verporten. That could have absolutely been on Thomas. It could have been on Lee. That could have been on Landau. That could have been any of them.
Well,
anyway, yeah. I'll tell you, 74 is probably my favorite year for Marvel. And I feel like that's a point where, yeah, ironically, I think maybe the reason why Thomas finally walks or at least leaves the editor position in 74 is because finally he was accomplishing some sizable things. We had new talent who'd really come into their own. We had all these amazing new titles out. You know, we had all these new formats going on as well. Thomas was, you know, making it work. He was thriving and, you know, was still being treated with such tremendous disrespect in the process. We've mentioned before Al Landau, who's the president of Cadence, who oversees, theoretically, he and Stan Lee have the same level of power, but Stan always agrees with whatever Al says, as at least the way Roy sees it. Al gets to call the shots. So in 1974, there's a major issue where, and I'm not sure who the artist was, but there was it was apparently a normal thing where artists would, when trying to switch from one company to the other, would exaggerate how much they were being paid so that the other company would one-up it and pay them even more. And Stan basically said, you know, we got to put a stop to this. So he worked out an arrangement with Carmine Infantino where what they were going to do was they were going to be in constant contact with each other, sharing artist page rates with each other so that this couldn't happen anymore. And he told Roy that Roy needs to start talking with Carmine and coordinate this. And Roy not only said, no, 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 that's wrong, that you're going to piss off the artist. It's unnecessary. It's nickel and diming. It's inappropriate. He actually writes a whole letter to Stan Lee, a memo, and he uses the exact phrase unethical, immoral, and quite possibly illegal. And then he steers clear of the office for like a day. And when he finally comes back, Stan calls him in the office, and Stan, planning to start this whole long speech, begins by saying, I suppose that you consider this your letter of resignation. But, and Roy just cuts him off and goes, doesn't matter. Probably best if I leave Marvel. And, you know, Stan is able to convince him not to leave Marvel entirely, you know, but he steps out of the editor position and he makes the deal. He's only staying at Marvel if he gets to be his own editor while being a writer, which I know George loves.
What a surprise.
And then after that, you know, there's a total vacuum until Shooter comes along. You have, you know,
Archie Goodwin.
You've got Goodwin, you've got Ween, you've got Wolfman, you've got some other people in there for a very short period of time. But it's a constant.
One other person between Wolfman and Goodwin, Jerry Conway for 3 months.
That was what I was trying to think of. Yeah.
Yeah. That was a disaster.
Was it 3 months? I thought it was like 2 weeks.
Yeah, I thought it was shorter than that too. But Conway was always taking on more than he could handle. But the whole idea that, you know, Roy was the only logical successor to steer the ship. And once he finally says enough is enough and steps away, Stan doesn't have anyone else waiting in the wing who can really do this job adequately. And so the company, and I think that's really when the theft picks up, George. And that's when people start really getting lazy because there's really nobody watching. You know, I brought up the point before that Stan didn't actually love comics the way that Roy Thomas did. He loved creating comics. He cared about the characters deeply. But he didn't have the love for the medium that Roy did. And, you know, ultimately was willing to risk the integrity of the company for getting to be able to still say that he was in charge. And I think ultimately, Roy in many ways saved Marvel. And I don't just mean fiscally. I don't just mean in terms of, you know, Star Wars and all that Jim Shooter applauds him for. But I think if Roy hadn't been there, there wouldn't have been someone at the head who cared about maintaining Stan's integrity, who could put up with Stan's ego and the fact that Stan would come in and throw him under the bus whenever it was convenient, who was going to fight for, you know, all this stuff and bring in new blood, new people with new ideas and give them the freedom to do what they wanted to. I really think Marvel might have died before someone like Shooter could walk in the door and put on a new course if Roy hadn't been there.
He was certainly important.
Slandered.
Sure.
Yeah.
But let's start overall. The big question at the end: what did Marvel gain under Thomas? What did Marvel lose under Thomas? In hindsight, what did Roy do well? What did Roy do badly? What's the whole big mess? Rob, you're our special guest. Why don't you start us off?
He put out a lot of good comics under his watch. He somehow found enough good people and who wanted to do good work and got them into print. And they tried new formats. They tried new genres. They got to partnership with the Electric Company. Did stories for kids. They did.
I remember those.
Yeah, they did prose. They did giant size stuff. They did treasury size. They tried a lot of things, and a lot of it was good comics too. Not just new formats, but classic writers and artists.
Yeah.
Stories that I still remember.
And what do you think that Roy might have, what might Marvel have lost under Roy? Where might he have failed Marvel or not been strong enough?
Leaving it set up so that somebody else could step into his job. I mean, they really, like you said, that there wasn't a pipeline of who the next logical editor was going to be. It was kind of interesting that they chose Len Wein next.
He might have been setting up Conway, although Conway clearly couldn't handle it. But, you know, if you remember when Roy took over the core titles and didn't trust anybody else with them, he trusted Conway with them.
Yeah.
But Conway was young and overeager and, you know, wasn't afraid to phone it in to make an extra buck. And so that wasn't going to work. But I wouldn't be surprised if that's what Roy was trying to do there.
Yeah. They also gave Archie Goodwin a few of the core titles, at least a while. Yeah,
that's true. And also, to be sure, I think if Stan hadn't screwed him over as many times as he did, you know, I think Roy might have stayed there forever. I mean, he's still freaking running Alter Ego. They're about to hit issue 200, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's all these years later. I mean, he became the editor of Marvel, and he's still working on the fanzine he was doing when he was a kid. That's crazy. I mean, I think that's the kind of person he is, and he is loyal. He is devoted. He is committed. He has no ego. Maybe he would have run Marvel forever. Maybe.
Maybe. Yeah.
George, what do you got? What did Marvel gain under Roy? What did Marvel lose under Roy?
Well, okay, you know, again, I was willing to admit that they did gain some new up-and-coming talent. Maybe this is something that has to be done periodically, where you bring in new blood And he certainly did that. So that's a plus to him. What they lost was that maybe this wasn't his fault, but since he's the one in charge while it was happening, he has to take the hit on it. Mm-hmm. But he allowed for people to edit their own books. And I think that opened the door for people to sort of abusing that and making less of an effort to create something good. So, I mean, that laid the groundwork for people to say, well, hey, look, we can get away with this. So let me do less work and still get the same money. So it's that. I'm not sure that's really all his fault either, because they said that when he took over and he left, they realized they needed a lot more editors to edit the books. He couldn't do it all himself. And actually, Jim Shooter, when he came along, he started bringing in editors to edit certain lines. Like one editor would do all the Spider-Man books, another one would do all the Avengers-related books. So it was that. It's something needed to happen, but he wasn't the one to put it there. But like you said, he only lasted about three years, so maybe that would have came. But
we also don't know, where the ball was dropped. Was that lax atmosphere, Roy? Was that what happened afterwards when Wolfman and when it was passing editors all the time and people were checked out, not taking it fully seriously?
Well, I mean, what I meant was that he opened the door for that to evolve into something where people started abusing it.
Yes. He didn't give that level of trust.
Did he open it, or was he just unable to close it?
A little bit of both, I think.
He was unable to edit every book. So what he actually said was, look, guys, I trust that you're going to do it well. If it don't sell, you're fired.
And I don't think we can...
Bottom line thing.
Yeah, I don't think we can underestimate or underplay the fact that most of these creators he knew before they came down to Marvel through his first Friday meetings in his house, in his apartment, that he had a relationship with these people. He had a sense of them. Once he was gone, that level of trust didn't make sense anymore, because Wolfman didn't hire these people and didn't know them beforehand. And Ween didn't know them beforehand. And Goodwin didn't know them beforehand. And certainly Conway didn't. Maybe Roy could pull that trick in a way that nobody else could.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe.
I don't know. We don't know. You know people. You know them superficially, and then you give them something to do and they prove themselves. They have to prove themselves over and over again.
That's true. And trust in a big business when money is involved is always a risky thing. Always.
It worked for the most part, because a lot of the people that he did hire, they did a good enough job,
Yeah.
They didn't just disappear right away, but.
And also because he had no real power, because Stan could veto anything. I think he
overstated that too. He had a lot of power. It's just that the final word was Stan.
He had power until Stan decided he didn't like something he did. And Stan wasn't afraid to call him out on that in front of everybody else and undermine him.
But hold on. But how many things actually did Stan veto?
The Gwen Stacy one is massive. That
he didn't veto it. That actually happened.
He just threw him under the bus very publicly in a huge way. And so I think all Roy had to go on was his charm and his kindness. And once he's gone, those people have no real reason to be loyal to the company anymore, do they?
I guess.
I want to be clear, as much as I'm, fighting you on this. I do think I have a love-hate relationship with Roy's lax editing style. I don't think he had a better choice, but I think it did have the potential to create a lot of problems. And I think he spoiled Starlin. I think if Starlin had come up at DC, and I'm not sure Starlin ever would have worked for DC, but if he had, I think he would have come out as a very different type of creator. But I think
he would have quit.
Yeah, probably. Or been fired.
I love Starlin, but boy, he mixes it up a lot.
Would have been dangled out a window. It's what would have happened. But and I'm ready for my tinfoil hat theory at this point, talking about Roy Thomas.
Tinfoil hat theories.
And this one is, George, I'm going to admit this right now, this is my most far-fetched stretch yet. So you can absolutely rip this one apart. I fully realize this one is gutsy.
Okay? Now you have me scared, because you said some wild stuff to this point.
This is going to be my most wackadoodle one yet, for sure. I think Roy Thomas would be a much more revered name in a world where Jim Shooter had never happened. And not for the reasons you might think. Superhero comics had grown stale. People didn't want them anymore. Sales were going down. And worse than that, you had both Cadence and DC also really trying to make sure that those characters didn't change. They stayed intact. The illusion of change. You know, nothing really changes from issue to issue. Cadence, on top of that, had also forbidden them from doing story arcs for a while. It had to be single self-contained issues where things are reset at the end. Superheroes were dead as a genre. And if you look at what was happening at early Marvel, you know, when you have characters like Thor and Doctor Strange and Silver Surfer, they weren't really superheroes. They were in a shared universe, but they were fantasy and science fiction. And so Roy realizes that taking comics out into other genres is a way to make comics new again and re-engage the fan base. And as a result, you know, we have all these amazing, ambitious new experiments being done in jungle stories, in post-apocalyptic science fiction stories, and in everything. And it wasn't working for sales numbers. Marvel was doing better than DC and everybody else, but all the comics were still doing poorly. But, you know, it was only a few years away. The direct market. Had Marvel inched along to the beginning of the direct market without Jim Shooter coming in, and I'll talk about him in a moment, I think what Roy Thomas did would have really paid off. I think comics would have found a whole new fresh beginning. I think they'd be doing much more ambitious things now. I think we'd have more comic books where companies aren't afraid to let a comic end when its story is done and do something new and totally different again, instead of retreading the same stuff and going back to the same well again and again. That's what Roy Thomas was proving could absolutely work. And then Jim Shooter came in and right off the bat starts canceling all of these lower tier comics that are really creative and doing fresh and new things, and instead trying to bring on fresh new voices to reinvigorate your Thors and your Daredevils and essentially create the illusion of change again. And he makes superheroes the dominant genre again, and then Marv Wolfman at DC does the same thing, playing from Jim Shooter's playbook. Had they not done that, I think Roy Thomas would have been the godfather of a very different comic industry today.
That's an interesting theory. Mm-hmm. Would they have survived?
Well, that's the big question.
That's the question.
And I would point to the fact, too, that Marvel was making very poor use of their merchandising licenses. You know, maybe if they'd gotten smarter about that when money was getting tight, if Star Wars hadn't been a cash cow, they might have found a way to make it. But you're right. They might very well have failed. DC somehow survived. I don't know how DC made it.
And there's another question. At what point did Marvel start doing the Dead of Dreadline Doom? Was it under Roy Thomas, or was it under Marv Wolfman, or was it under other people?
I don't know.
When did it get to that bad point where people had to keep putting in reprint titles or not shipping or whatever?
Yeah.
That hurt them a lot.
Sure.
Again, the money they were losing on that was unbelievable.
Yeah. One thing that Shooter does, for better and for worse, is he comes in with a business sense and he's watching the dollars. And Roy Thomas was never asked to do that. My point is simply that if Marvel had managed to stay alive long enough to limp along to that point, and they couldn't have known it was coming. There was no way they could have seen it coming. But if they'd survived long enough for the direct market to happen, I think Marvel, the Roy Thomas version of Marvel, would have exploded and done amazing things. But when they're playing to a general audience, that was rougher. That was harder.
I was a kid during that era. I loved that era.
Yeah. You know? But for some reason, it wasn't bringing in the dollars because, you know, you had to be a specific age and a specific demographic for that to speak to you. Yeah, otherwise, yeah. But I mean, the idea that Master of Kung Fu was, you know, early on the slate to be canceled because the sales weren't there, even though it was a high quality book.
Well, there's also the question of the sales figures being almost completely inaccurate because of affidavit return fraud.
Well, that's true for sure.
Yeah. Nobody knew how many they were selling.
Imagine you're an exec at Cadence and you've acquired this company, you know, really. And I don't know if Sean Howe is correct in this, but the way that he presents it in Marvel Comics, The Untold Story, they weren't even looking to acquire Marvel Comics per se. They were looking to acquire Goodman Publications, and Marvel Comics kind of came along for the ride and ended up being very profitable for a while. If you were a businessman who wasn't into comics and was only marginally into publishing, and you weren't spending every day at the Marvel offices. You know, and it's time to cancel some books. You know, do you really need to look at sales numbers to say Killraven and Shang-Chi need to go, Spider-Man stays?
Well, if you want to be accurate, you do.
If they cared about that.
So, yeah, you know, I mean, it's interesting. It's interesting to speculate what could have happened.
Sure. Yeah. It's interesting, though. Roy Thomas is so forgotten, you know, and you know, I don't fault you, George, for the fact that in the beginning you didn't think he did anything. Because, like, there was Marvel had a big anniversary recently, and they invited all these people from the early days, and they didn't invite Roy Thomas. And, you know, he was doing an interview. He was a little salty about this. Like, they didn't think they invited Claremont. He wasn't there in the beginning. I was.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. He's just, he was in Stan's shadow, and that's why Stan liked him. That's why he's the only one who could have done that job. Somebody who had an ego, Jim Shooter could not have survived. I think he was so good at what he did that he became irrelevant because,
well, you know, Jeff, I want to say this. 3 years is not a long time. If you look at the last two or three editor-in-chiefs that Marvel had, they lasted 8, 9, 10 years.
Sure, but look at all that we've already determined he accomplished in that time. But look at all the people he brought in, all the titles he created.
No, for sure.
All that
but 3 years is not long.
It's not, but that's actually more impressive. Look at all that he did as a result. And I would still argue once again, I think Marvel wouldn't have made it if there hadn't been a Roy Thomas there.
Well, I can agree with that.
Well, gentlemen, it's been a pleasure today for sure. Rob, I want to thank you so much for your firsthand experience and your knowledge and your in-depth everything about this. George, thank you for not drawing me naked. That's huge to me. And thanks to everyone listening at home and in your cars and wherever else you may be checking us out. Listen, don't be sad the episode's over, because you can always follow us over to classiccomics.org, where the conversation never stops. And if that's not enough for you, don't forget to check us out at patreon.com/theclassiccomicsforum, where you can gain access to the hidden, secret, which connects you to a wealth of other information and content, including our brand new weekly series, Off the Cuff, where George and I have a range of unscripted conversations from all sorts of topics, from Vince Coletta in strip clubs, to Mike Carlin behind closed doors, to John Byrne and whether or not it was in fact a porno. Again, patreon.com/theclassiccomicsforum. Thanks to Paul King, the creator, performer, writer of the Classic Comics Forum theme song. Thanks as well to Scott Harris King, no relationship, for creating the original Classic Comics Forum podcast and letting us take it from there. And a special, huge, massive thank you to our Patreon supporters who make this all possible, including Bill Sinclair, Marty Golia, Michael Gallagher, Paolo Zicadu, Tim Schneider, and Berkeley. We couldn't do it without you guys and appreciate you so incredibly much. CCF and Def is produced in partnership with the Classic Comics Forum. Check us out at classiccomics.org or on Facebook. See you next time.
ComicsComics.org